from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Since the turn of the 20th century, the life expectancy in the developed world has risen from just shy of 50 years to nearly 80. But how much higher will it or can it get? Author David Ewing Duncan's new book, When I'm 164, argues that advances in medicine and bionics will drastically increase our life expectancy in the next 30 to 50 years. He also discusses the potential social, environmental, and economic dimensions of extending our lives, and he'll join us for the hour ahead. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum Hour. As we advance in science and technology, we may indeed be on the verge of dramatically increasing our lifespans beyond the present roughly 40. Bay Area-based author, broadcaster, and journalist David Ewing Duncan joins us in studio for this hour to discuss extending life dramatically and what it would mean. His new book, a TED book, an e-book, is titled When I'm 164, The New Science of Life Extension and What Happens If It Succeeds. A recipient of a Magazine Story of the Year award from the Association for the Advancement of Science, David Ewing Duncan is also founding director of the Center for Life Science Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, a correspondent for The Atlantic and Nova Science Now, and a former special correspondent and producer for Nightline. His previous books include Masterminds, Genius DNA, and The Quest to Rewrite Life, and he also wrote the international bestseller Calendar, Humanity's Epic Struggle to Determine a True and Accurate Year, which has been published now in 20 languages. He's former contributing editor to Wired, Discover, Condé Nast, Portfolio, and MIT Technology Review, and he writes for National Geographic, Fortune, The New York Times, and Harper's, among many others, and can also be heard with Moira Gunn on Sundays on Tech Nation. And good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, you've done an e-book. That's brave in itself. But you're also talking about A Brave New World here. And let's get into it, because the idea – I remember going to the Tech Museum a number of years ago on the occasion of my friend Stuart Brand's 60th birthday. And he said, well, I'm just middle-aged. You know, I'm going to live at least till 120. And we're on the cusp of that. I mean, this is not something that one is even joking about anymore, as you point out, with improved hygiene and nutrition and new discoveries, bionics, all that It's inevitable.
I think it is. And in fact, looking back historically, we already, over the last century, have almost doubled lifespan. If you were born around 1900 or in the late 19th century, you would have lived maybe to your mid-40s. Now we're pushing 80. And I saw a chart, which we put in the book, from the United Nations, which really staggered me, which is that even without all of these potential fixes with genetics and all that, which we'll get into, we are supposed to live, according to the UN, up to maybe 100 years old over the next century. So we'll be bumping up against a lot.
In the developed world.
Well, that's in the developed world. Curiously enough, the developing world, while it's, you know, not surprisingly, is lagging. We'll be up by in a century or so. It'll be in the lower 90s. And in fact, that was another – there's interesting statistics here slipped in here and there in the book that I found fascinating. One is that the developing world has moved very rapidly in life expectancy as well. I think it's around 67 years old now, which is up quite a bit from just a few years back.
Well, there's all this new science of radical life extension too. Let's talk about some of that because – I mean, of course, you get in immediately when you think about life extension, the quality of life. But before we get onto that, let's just look at the science, which you've done a yeoman's job of bringing to our attention and delineating for us. We're talking about all kinds of Brave New World things. I mean, with stem cells, with extending gene pathways, with, as I said before, bionics, regenerative organs. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And cancer drugs targeting, and you mentioned so many of these things. There's so much that you have to get your mind around it all.
I mean, well, you really do. And in fact, the research community itself, you know, mainstream science, there's always a lot of people out there, sort of pseudoscientists and others, actually forever have been talking about alchemists and other trying to push the boundaries of lifespan. And in a way, this has snuck up on all of us, including the scientific community, because obviously a major goal of biomedicine is to try to alleviate suffering, to eliminate slow down disease. And all of this, in a way, has coalesced into what's essentially a longevity. It's almost as if they set out to, you know, have this sort of longevity push. And I get into the book in some specific areas, especially in the last 20 years or so, you've had a true science of really anti-aging, if you will, or life extension. And even that is, if you ask a mainstream researcher, even at the National Institute of Aging, are you out to extend lifespan? They'll go, oh, no, you know, because that's still a little bit tainted. You know,
they'll even say no with more gusto if you ask them if they're out to conquer age and
right, or death.
Immortality. Yeah. Although I've always thought, well, maybe we can reverse the enzyme process or something like that. I mean, look, Da Vinci was talking about flying, and nobody would have believed that the Wright brothers, I mean, it's the same kind of thing in many ways, metaphorically, at least in my mind. You did a survey, though. I mean, you actually talked to or had queried about 30,000 people in terms of how long they'd like to live. Tell us about that.
Well, this was interesting, too. At the beginning of talks I give, and I've been giving talks about the future of biomedicine and all that for years. The last 3 or 4 years, just to get audiences kind of warmed up, I ask them how long they would like to live. And it started out very informally. I give four answers just to quantify it easily. It's 80 years, 120 years, 150 years, or forever. And so I asked for a show of hands, and I probably asked 30,000 plus people this, and it's very consistent. You want me to give the results?
Yeah, break it down.
Actually, let me ask you first, Michael. How would you vote?
Entirely depending on the quality of life.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's unpredictable. I mean, if there were a lot of tubes in me and I was suffering and everything, you know, let me go as fast as I can. On the other hand, if I still felt vital and robust and involved in life, not necessarily immortal, but, you know, I could see 120, something like that. That sounds crazy, frankly. Actually, we'll put that question out to our listeners. In fact, we'd like you to go to Facebook and let us know how long would you like to live and maybe why you would choose that particular number. But for me, it's utterly dependent, I have to admit, on the quality of life. And what about you, David?
Well, actually, let me just add that we have an online survey that you can take, too, that we've had over 30,000 people take, and it's an ongoing interactive on whenim64.com. So please come.
When I'm 164.
When I'm 164.
Yeah, see, you still got the Paul McCartney Beatles in your head there, when I'm 64.
Exactly.
But what did you discover? And then I'll ask you about yourself. I mean, in terms of these 30,000, not that many want to be immortal, right?
No. In fact, the results were a little surprising to me. About 60% said 80, and about 30% said 120. And by the way, these were chosen specifically. 80 is about as long as the human life expectancy is in the West at the moment. 120 is about as long as anyone has lived. So that's kind of the outer edge. So we had about 30% there. 150, you would have to imagine some kind of scientific fix. Although when I asked the question, I said, don't necessarily imagine that. You know, you're free to, but that's not a criteria here. So we had about 10% or a little less than 10%, and then less than 1% went forever, for forever.
Well, I didn't think any organism was immortal, and then I learned otherwise from your book. Water bears are immortal.
Water bears, these little tiny microscopic animals that look like the Michelin Man when you put them under a microscope, they live in lichen. And basically, no one knows, of course, you can't test to see if they're immortal, but they do seem to completely shut down and go into essentially stasis when they're stressed out. They even put these little guys in outer space on one of the space shuttle missions and put them in the vacuum of space, and they just shut down, and then they revive themselves once they were back in a more conducive environment.
And you mentioned living to 120. Jean Clement was a woman who lived to just shy of 123, but how unusual is that? I mean, I know there's a tribe up somewhere in the Caucasus, supposedly, that live into centenarian years and all that, but very rare. Although you got like rockfish living 300 to 400 years. I mean, these are sort of fascinating span and continuum of there's this Methuselah in Eastern California.
Yeah, that's right. The Methuselah tree. This is a bristle pine cone tree that's lived well over 4,000 years. And what this tells you, Michael, is that, and this is where the science of anti-aging really began to take on some seriousness. In other organisms, you do have these extraordinary lifespans. And even more interesting, sometimes you have similar organisms, you know, from a biological standpoint, who live very different lifespans depending on how they've evolved. And so this suggests something going on in genetics and in evolution, that it's an advantage to live an extraordinarily long time for some organisms.
So when you did this canvassing of all these thousands of people, did you find out anything that's particularly a beacon of understanding to us in terms of why they selected?
Well, in the last year or so, as I began to think, you know, I might write the book and kind of getting really fascinated by these responses, I began asking a lot of people why. And in fact, you get – so like you, I kind of put you on the spot, right? And you had to think for a minute. It's just, you know, this is very much from the gut. You know, people sometimes they have thought about it, but usually they haven't. So you're getting some really interesting insight into how people think. And in the book, we have eight reasons why people would want to live to be – I'm sorry, four reasons why people would want to live to be 150 and eight reasons why they wouldn't. And this is just a coalescing all the different responses. But it's things like people who want to live to be 150 or 164, you know, would want to – they have a lot to do in life and they want to keep going. Others want to see what the future will hold. And so you get a lot of different reasons. On the downside, you have things like people who are concerned about population or, say, the environment, you know, the depletion of resources. If everybody stopped dying suddenly one day, about 57 million people die a year. You know, you can imagine what that would do over time to the planet. Not that that's going to happen, but you begin to see where people are thinking. Others have very personal responses, like the cost of doubling lifespan. So it was interesting.
It's also interesting to read about a lot of these new drugs and therapies for aging, for heart disease, for diabetes, which you bring into focus, molecular level of research and nanotechnology. One of the things that struck me the most was the I mean, I'm just talking about scientific breakthroughs now. Well, let me get the Sirtuus, is that what it's called?
Sirtuus, yes.
Sirtuus, yeah. It's to treat inflammation and other diseases, but it turns out it also seems to slow the aging process in mice and other animals.
Well, yes, and that's a company, by the way, that was acquired with great fanfare a few years back by GlaxoSmithKline, the pharma giant. They spent $720 million on this little company that actually came out of research into anti-aging around the activation of a particular gene. And it actually turns out to be a family of genes called CRT genes, S-I-R-T. And these genes seem to have some regulatory property genetically that activate pathways that certainly extend lifespan in other animals. And they are developing a pill. And since the FDA doesn't have a criteria for extending lifespan as one of their endpoints for a drug, the company has taken some diseases of aging, in this case inflammation. But as one of the people I interviewed, the scientist, said to me, it could be a side effect for this drug that you would extend lifespan.
We don't know yet. It's the bottom line, yeah?
We don't know. And obviously, it's hard to test this in humans. You know, we live a very long time. To run a true experiment, you'd have to probably take 100 years or so.
And what about stem cells? I mean, you know, we've done a lot of programs on them, and I've done things with I did something at my alma mater, University of Wisconsin, with James Thompson, whom you write about in your book, one of the leading researchers. But we're a long way off here. And in fact, it's even Thompson who tells us we're a long way off. There's been a lot of hype.
Well, yes, and I want to be careful with this book. You know, I'm a science writer, and I once wrote a column actually for the Chronicle called The Biopragmatist. So I want to be careful here that I don't oversell this. And in fact, I've had to be convinced in a way that we might be heading in this direction. No one knows when exactly. I mean, maybe over the next century, maybe sooner. Many of these therapies are probably decades away. Some of them could be close. That pill that Sirtuus is developing is in phase two human trials. If it ends up working, you're talking about a few years away. So We'll wait and see.
You touch upon cryogenics, too. I mean, you know, a lot of people used to ridicule the whole idea, you know, Ted Williams and all people, Walt Disney wanted to be frozen, but maybe it's not something so ridiculous.
Well, I put that in a special box, you know, next to the science section, because it's still, in my view, really pseudoscience. It would be certainly nice. In fact, my choice might be if I could take my family and a group of friends and freeze myself down for a few years and wake up 50 years from now. I'm in the camp that would love to see what the future is like.
But the technology exists for the cells, and it also exists for simple organisms at this point, doesn't it?
Simple organisms. There's mammals. They haven't been able to revive. I mean, it's still a real crapshoot. You also have to inconveniently be dead before you get frozen down. So you probably died of something, you know, cancer or heart disease.
A minor research obstacle.
Yeah. Right. So there's an awful lot you would have to overcome in the future. But there are a few diehards, a few hundred people, including Ted Williams. You go down in the Silicon Valley, and interestingly enough, some of the, you know, the tech famous tech celebrities down there wear their little necklace or their bracelet that says, if I die suddenly, here's what you do.
Talking to David Ewing Duncan, and he has an e-book out all about extending life. His new book is titled When I'm 164, The New Science of Life Extension and What Happens If It Succeeds. And I'll invite those of you who are listening to join this conversation and put the question out to you. How long would you want to live if you could extend your lifespan indefinitely? Would you want to live forever? Would you want to live to 120, 180, 160, 164? Or just say, you know, 80, things start going on downhill, hips break and all kinds of things like that. So maybe that's the time to just move on to whatever the other dimension is that we cannot divine, to use that word advisedly. Join us. We welcome you to this conversation. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And I'd like to hear from you on this. Again, if you have questions or comments, you can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways that you can join us in this hour. You can go to our Facebook page. You can also go to our webpage, our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. By the way, the website is also good for downloading previous programs of Forum. I get a lot of people asking, how can I hear something I missed, or how can I hear something that I wanted to hear? But you can always hear it any time you want to now by simply going to the website and going to our archives. But you can join us in the moment here on the subject of extending life, and how long would you like to live and why? Talking to David Ewing Duncan, leading science writer and journalist and broadcaster, it would certainly extend the bucket list, if nothing else. But it also, it occurs to me that, as you said, there are so many things on the planet that aren't sustainable. There's so many environmental and planetary problems that come into focus with this whole question of extending lifespan. I remember former governor of Colorado, Richard Lamb, saying the leaves have to fall from the tree and new leaves have to grow. And he was talking about, I think, about euthanasia or about pulling plugs. But the points were well taken. I mean, how long can you go on with Social Security and welfare and entitlements like that? And how long can you bleed the planet of its resources?
Well, it's interesting. One of the reasons that I launched this project was because I go to a lot of meetings where people think very optimistically and you know, think that the future will be a better place. And I actually got a little frustrated with the kind of lack of really thinking out what it would mean for even a few individuals, if not a lot of individuals, living for a very long time. And, you know, we've got 7 billion plus people on the planet right now. You know, according to UN estimates, it could be as much as 11 billion, you know, over this century. You know, adding a bunch of people is a huge issue. It affects the environment, the carbon footprint, all of those issues.
And the young people will not be able to advance as easily because people want to stay where they are and not open the way for the young. On the other hand, I guess as you point out, you have many more years perhaps for the Einsteins and the Steve Jobs and people like that.
Well, you also would have more years for the Stalins
and
you know, the darker side. So you got to think that one out. Too. I mean, we would all love to have, you know, some of the geniuses around. I talk about Thomas Edison in the book. You know, if we're going to solve, say, global warming with all these extra people, we might need, you know, a few genius inventors like that around to help us get there.
Talk a little bit about this. You have a whole section on Darwin's tortoise.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinated people. Darwin, in the famous expedition in the HMS Beagle back in 1835 in the Galapagos Islands, someone, maybe him, by legend he did it. It was probably someone in the crew, found a tortoise named – which they named Harriet. And this was a young tortoise at the time. And Harriet just died a few years back in 2006 in Australia at the ripe age of 176.
And it sits right there in the writings of Darwin, all about Harriet. It's also fascinating little nuggets in this ebook you've done. I have a friend, John DeLuca, who used to be head of the wine consortium, you know, and he did a lot to make people more aware of the fact that wine is good for your health, and it is. 60 Minutes did a whole piece on this and so forth. But according to your research, you'd need about 700 bottles of wine a day to really have effect in terms of a possible extension of longevity.
Well, that's right, and that goes to a substance we all, I'm sure most people remember reading about, the substance in red wine that was announced a few years back called resveratrol. And it's a naturally occurring substance actually in grape skins, and it ends up in wine. And it does have some properties in lesser – or I don't mean lesser organisms, but less complicated organisms. And even in mice, it has been shown to massive doses of resveratrol. But if you took the massive dose that was given to mice, say, who got a slight bump in lifespan increase, we humans would have to drink some extraordinary amount. And I don't know about you, Michael, but I start losing it at around 200 bottles.
I have far greater resistance than I do. There's also just – I want to go to our callers here, but I've been talking about biotechnology broadly. But artificial organs and all the digitalization and all the ways of possibly controlling one's internal organs is also a part of this whole kind of Huxley Brave New World. I mean, it's up ahead.
Well, it is. And you know, most people who seriously think about this say it will probably be a combination of many things. I mean, we've talked a lot about the genetics, and that would literally be almost like pulling, you know, pushing forward a throttle. You know, the whole organism sort of moves, you know, forward or ages more slowly. But you've also got, you know, using stem cells to regenerate organs, and we're a long way from that, as we mentioned in humans. It could happen at some point. And then there's the whole section in the book called Machine Solutions. And since really many centuries, we humans have been using machine-generated devices, you know, eyeglasses, things like that. You're getting into an age where bits and pieces of things can go wrong inside of humans, like, say, hearing or eyesight, can now be fixed to some extent with the addition of machines, pacemakers. And there are an awful lot of people walking around having more years added to their lives because of pacemakers. And the list goes on when you really get into the leading edge now of that fusion between machine and human.
It also means that the old ways of calculating what your likely lifespan will be, you know, by taking your parents' ages when they died and all of these are subject to big changes, as we've indicated up ahead. We're talking to David Ewing Duncan. And by the way, September 7th, he'll be at the Modernism Gallery in San Francisco at 5:30 for an ebook launch. That in itself almost sounds paradoxical, but we will anticipate that. And you ought to know, again, the title of the book. It is an ebook. It's called When I'm 164, The New Science of Radical Life Extension and What Happens If It Succeeds. And, again, we'd like to hear from you. You can join us with any questions or comments you have, but how long would you like to live and why do you come to that conclusion? You can post it on our Facebook page or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and we'll go to your calls when we return and your emails. And the number for your calls again, 866-733-6786. That's toll free. Feel free to join the program and the conversation. You're listening to Forum. That's the name of the program. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and since the turn of the 20th century, life expectancy in the developed world has risen from just shy of 50 years to nearly 80, but how much higher will it or can it get? Author David Ewing Duncan's new book, When I'm 164, argues that advances in medicine and bionics will drastically increase our life expectancy in the next 30 to 50 years. He also discusses the potential social, environmental, and economic implications of extending our lives, and he'll be at the Modernism Gallery on the 7th of September in San Francisco at 5:30 for an ebook launch. You can join this conversation. We're asking you actually to let us know either by phone or by Facebook or by email how long you would like to live and why. And I did ask that question of David Ewing Duncan earlier, and he managed to, both of us managed to evade it. What do you say to that question?
Well, if I'm pushed into a corner, I would probably be in the maybe 100 to 120 camp. But I'm like you. If I have quality of life, if I'm doing wonderful, meaningful things, you know, have friends, family around, I would probably push that out. But I have serious problems actually as a citizen of the planet, taking up the space. And we haven't talked about that, but it really made me think when I began to consider that if I'm 164, I might have the job of my great-great-great-grandchild. I mean, how many jobs can we create? We're already having a huge problem with that right now on the planet. So I think people have different reactions.
Well, in fact, some say I wouldn't want to live that long because I'd be too bored. I mean, George Sanders, the actor, supposedly when he checked out by suicide, said, I was just bored, There are people who find, like you say, I think the key, and this gets into deeper questions about the meaning of life, has a lot to do with your vitality and your sense of purpose and what ignites in you and what sets you on a course of one sort or another, what gives you pleasure. Well, as I said, we asked our listeners on Facebook, how long do you want to live? How long is too long and why? And Patrick writes, I want 2 million years, since that gives me a reasonable probability of seeing a significant sample of the galaxy. Another listener named Ramin asks, these numbers are starting to look biblical. What are going to be the consequences of longer lifespans on healthcare costs? Obviously, healthcare for advanced ages are going to be going higher and higher. Does that mean that the retirement age will have to be going up correspondingly?
Yep. Well, I think all of those are questions. You know, when Social Security and especially – well, Social Security back in the 30s and Medicare in the 60s was devised, the guys calculating at the bean counters never imagined that people would be living much past 65. We're quite a bit above that now. And, you know, if you really can double lifespan and slow aging and you have the body of a 40-year-old when you're 60 or 70 and on up, does it make sense to retire? Does it make sense certainly to pay out from our dwindling national treasury around Social Security, make payments to people who are still very vibrant?
And what about those long pensions? I mean, you have police and fire people and GIs, military people retiring now in their early 50s and so forth. You're going to triple that age and just keep paying, almost in some instances full pay pensions? Wow. What happens to the coffers then? Andrew writes on Facebook, I'm 26 now, and I think life on Earth will begin to lose its appeal after a while. I'm hoping that I'm able to transcend life on Earth after a while and begin to yearn for the next adventure, whatever that may be. So I don't have a number for you, just a state of mind. I want to live until I'm ready to die. Andy says, I'm excited about the possibility of longer life, but is there any chance I can have those extra years now rather than when I'm 95? All right. Let's go to your calls. And we begin, Mary, with you. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. You guys are making me feel really selfish, but I was saying to your screener that I'm 79. Years ago, I might have said 80 would be fine, but now I want to live at least till I'm 120. And I think that the unusual thing about this is that we all think of quality of life, and I have been a paraplegic all my life, and I would think that might be one of the things that would make people say, I don't want to live any longer, and it certainly has not, and I really just cannot stand the thought of not getting to find out what happens.
Why, good for you, Mary. That's inspiring to hear you. Thank you for your call. In fact, when you're talking about expanded life, you do think about a healthy and healthy expanded life generally. We've been talking about quality of life. Even if the body can hold out, there's the brain and dementia.
Yes. One of the interesting things about the genetic fix is these pathways that maybe control or sort of a throttle on aging. Will the brain actually age more slowly, and what will that mean? I mean, there's some interesting kind of physiological questions here. Will women's reproduction, which obviously has a enormous implications. It's a huge debate.
You haven't read Ann Packer's new novel, have you?
No. I haven't.
They're able to extend it beyond even menopause in that novel.
You know? Well, that if your body's truly slowing down by half, women be able to have babies much later. That already is an interesting issue, which I'm sure you've discussed many times on the show. But how does it affect physiology is another question.
And we'll go to more of our callers. And Jay joins us next. Jay, you're on Forum. Good morning.
Exceptional discussion, gentlemen. My name's Jay John. I've done cryonics training, and I've participated in freezing individuals for later resuscitation with the American Cryonic Society in the Silicon Valley. Yes, this is real. Yes, it will occur. Your discussion is addressing a lot of other issues that are contingent upon the resuscitation of the individual. That hasn't happened yet, but it is being addressed at Stanford, at the Singularity Institute. The American Cryonic Society has been discussing this for at least 40 years.
But you sound confident, Jay, about cryonics, and you heard David Ewing Duncan talk about it as still pseudoscience. It still really is in that phase of pseudoscience, isn't it?
No. People are being frozen. It's approximately 500 people.
No, I'm not worldwide. Talking about the fact that people are frozen. I'm talking about the efficacy or certainty that goes with the freezing of people.
There's no certainty whatsoever. Anyone who tells you that anyone's coming back is not fully...
That's the pseudoscience, yeah.
But then again, it was a pseudoscience before the Wright brothers got their airplane in the air. It was a pseudoscience before when Da Vinci was just talking about submarines and made those silly sketches about helicopters and submarines.
Excellent points, and points well taken. Thank you.
You want to know more, it's being done at Stanford. Look at the Singularity Institute. Go to the American Cryonic Society. It exists. It's real. It's going to happen.
All right, Jay, thank you. Certainly, I'm thinking about not Da Vinci, but all the science fiction writers who have put things square upon us that eventually came to pass. Here's Tim who writes, I used to work in medical research, but I find the premise of this discussion pretty sick. I don't want to shoot the messenger, but I would like to editorialize on the topic a bit. How selfish does one have to want to live to 164? It's beyond unnatural. Only the rich will be able to afford the technology to extend life that far, and those people, on average, consume the most resources and produce the most waste, thereby putting the rest of us at risk. There's only so much pie to go around, and the G20 mostly skimp on foreign aid to the third world, even though it's much cheaper to extend and improve life for them. Much of America's health expenses are used during end-of-life care. Now we are talking about possibly extending that costly period to decades. I worked in biotech, so I've seen a lot of oversold and overpromised health miracles. FDA, new drug approved rates are declining, drugs are less profitable, and healthcare austerity isn't going away. So maybe the 1% will live until 164, while the rest of us may actually have worse health in the future.
Well, and that's actually addressed in the book. And in fact, as I said earlier, the book was written in part out of frustration over a lot of people who seem rather starry-eyed at times about the idea of living a very long time and that science can get us there. in some ways, the book is a thought experiment, which is asking the question and raising some of the issues that the person that emailed sent in, which is what really happens if we do extend lifespan. And, I'm believing now, as a careful science writer, that there is some possibility here that this might happen. In fact, it's already happening, as we've said. I mean, lifespan is increasing about 3 years a decade already, even without some of these, more fancy or fanciful fixes.
Well, maybe the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, as has generally been the case. In fact, Jason tweets us and says, what about a class divide between the haves and the have-nots, between transhumans and humanists? Are we still human? And another tweet, why would any vibrant, healthy, non-depressed person ever want to die? Oh, yeah, poverty, cultural inertia. We are actively participating in evolution. Options and paradigms have all changed. Worldviews and institutions will adapt or die. Thomas writes on our Facebook page, I have a lot of respect for both Michael and David, but I have to correct the fallacy they started the conversation with this morning. Average life expectancy has increased dramatically over the past 100 years or so, but that is mostly due to the decrease in infant and childhood mortality because of better obstetrics care, vaccination, and antibiotics with relatively modest gains in total lifespan. better nutrition, safer working conditions for individuals who live to adulthood. It's not at all true that if you were born in 1900, you would live to about 40. Rather, if you were born in 1900, you had a higher probability of dying very young and dragging down the average lifespan to about 40 for the rest of the population. If you survived childhood, you had a decent chance of living to, say, 92, as my own 1900-born grandmother did. Yes, average lifespan has historically increased, and there is some interesting lifespan extension research underway that may someday help extend total possible lifespan, but that hasn't happened yet, and there is practically no biological or medical connection between the two.
Well, you know, I get this every single time, the idea of infant mortality skewing the statistics. And of course, that's true. And I can point to some studies that have actually taken that into account and still find a rather significant increase in life expectancy over the last 100 years. But I'm kind of wondering about those poor kids that we lost. I mean, do they simply not matter? I mean, today, most babies actually are alive. I mean, when I wrote a book years ago about life in the 16th century, half of all babies died within the first 5 years, and that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, but the point is well taken. I mean, lifespan has to do with just kind of averaging, and
that's right.
Infant mortality has made a big difference. Facebook writer is right.
No, absolutely, and it is a statistical sort of game, if you will. Another interesting answer, and I recognize that, of course.
But we do live longer than
I was about to say. I mean, when I was a kid in the '60s, my people in my family who were in their '60s were old. And we, they were considered to be, people who were elderly. Now someone in their 60s.
Yeah, I know. 60s today is the new 40.
It's the new whatever.
Give me enough of that. Here's Christine who writes, it's only appropriate that a reference to the boomers' beloved Beatles is brought to this discussion. And to answer the question implied by the title of your guest book, no, I will not love, need, or feed you when you're 164. Do your time and then please get out of the way. All right, let me go to some more callers. Carrie joins us. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning. I remember reading an article written by Isaac Asimov. It must be 30 or 40 years old, where he went and looked at the lifetime statistics for as many animals as he could get his hands on. And aside for humans, he said that the thing that was equivalent for most things from the short-lived mouse and the long-lived like elephant was the number of heartbeats they had throughout their lifetime. And I always meant to verify that, and I never really went and, looked that up. But I wonder, do you happen to know if is it true? And if it is, does that say anything about, mammals' biology?
I have not looked into that, although I do remember Asimov was so wonderful about finding sort of quirky things like that. I don't know. We'd have to probably just look it up. I mean, obviously, the heart rate in small animals is much greater. I'm sure we would have to. We were talking about statistics a moment ago. We'd have to, somehow deal with the differences.
Well, you've got some animals and organisms that hardly live at all. I mean, think about something as ephemeral as a butterfly, for example, and that ought to give us pause. I mean, because there is, as I said earlier, we can't just think of water bears here. There's a huge continuum in terms of lifespans.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some animals, microscopic creatures live minutes, even less. So, this is what's so interesting about how evolution has played a role in all of this. And our lifespans, too. We live a very long time for primates. We're the longest lived. The next down is our close cousins, the chimpanzees, which have an average life expectancy of about 53. So why – and this is still an open question that's hotly debated among scientists and anthropologists as to why do we live as long as we do?
Why do we live so much longer than chimps? I mean, that's about 20-year span more. They have, about 99% of the same DNA we do and all that?
Slightly less than that, but yes, very close.
Let me thank Carrie for her call, and we'll go to Menlo Park next and welcome Wynn. Good morning.
Morning. If you would ask me this question before 2004, I would have answered forever because as a Red Sox fan, I wanted to live long enough to see the World Series. And I wonder if the same thing would be true of all the Chicago Cubs fans who have been waiting as long as the Red Sox did.
That's very funny. And in fact, there's a across from Comiskey Park in Chicago, Larry Stone, former sports writer, the Examiner, wrote about this. There's a headstone. It's in Yiddish, but you translate it. It says, "The Cubs stink." So the guy took it to his grave, literally his disappointment in the Cubs. Let me get Vijay on here. Vijay, welcome.
Yeah, hi. My comment is that there is a lot of hype around this question of modern medicine extending the life expectancy. I mean, the last thing I saw was that the lifespan of whites in U.S. has actually declined by a few months in recent years. So my question is there even a single, single controlled study that shows that any particular medical intervention to date has extended the lifespan by even a few months? I mean, I'm talking about like the statins or the bypass surgery or the diabetes drug or the cancer treatment, all of these things.
Well, you actually cover a lot of ground. That's sort of complicated. I think what you're remembering is that the pace of life extension is actually, or life expectancy has slowed just a bit, mostly because of obesity and diabetes, and especially among younger people. And, you know, that is a concern anyway. That's a public health issue. You know, how much that will impact this life extension is yet to be seen.
We'll leave it there. Thank you, Vijay. And a lot of listeners are weighing in on Facebook. Again, we're asking the question, how long would you like to live and why? And a lot of class division stuff here. Like Anthony writes, this becomes the ultimate 1% problem, doesn't it? A huge number of unlucky, shorter-lived folks striving to support those few who can afford to prolong their pampered existences?
Well, I'm glad that's been brought up several times, and I would like to talk about that because medicine, unlike most technologies, biomedicine actually tends to add expense to what things cost, whereas many technologies, cell phones, personal computers, drive down costs. So yes, this could be extraordinarily expensive, and it could always be expensive, and it may benefit a small population. We haven't talked at all about the parts of the planet that can't find enough food each day either. I mean, how many people we can't feed everyone on the planet. So how many people will actually be able to get this? And that's why earlier I was talking about, as a global citizen, at least in my view, I find it somewhat troubling that we might be able to have a few people be these sort of, as I call them, longevinauts, if you will, that go off boldly into the future. And how many of us will actually be able to benefit from that?
Well, longevinauts, I like that. That's especially we did a little tribute to Neil Armstrong yesterday. It was good. A lot of listeners, as I say, weighing in on Facebook, and you can do the same by going to our Facebook page. Jeanette writes on Facebook, "Hi, Michael. I was born into a life of ignorance and poverty. I've suffered from ill health and addiction. I would love to have at least 50 extra years in order to catch up with those who were lucky enough to have a better start." Okay. You can weigh in here as well. Also by phone, 866-733-6786. And we'll go to another caller, and that's you. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I was going to address the issue of living forever versus 164. I think it reflects a kind of thinking where we're going to get advances in bioscience without equivalent advances or even greater advances in the other aspects of science. And I would be very happy to live forever on Mars, which probably would happen by then, and visit my family on the moon, because it's clearly where we're going with all these explorations of space, and clearly we're running out of resources. I mean, 57 million may die every year, but the number of new births, and with the environmental protections that even the underdeveloped countries are getting, so that their life expectancy is increasing leaps and bounds, we will not be able to sustain by any means the resources needed to support that kind of population without expanding the human species into other spaces, moons and Marses. So the issue of living forever, or even 164, is really moot at the moment, because the rest of the science will advance even faster.
Well, Mike, I think makes a good point here. I mean, there's just so much that the carrying capacity of the planet can sustain.
Absolutely. And in fact, as we mentioned earlier, with 7 billion people already on the planet, and that number is going up. Now, the increase in population globally, the increase is going down, which is, I suppose, good news. But, we might bump it up with this, living well beyond 80. And it's a huge issue. And in the book, I throw out a few statistics and charts about things like the supply of fossil fuels and water. These are big, big issues. And curiously enough,
they're already big issues.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, adding more people. And you've also got we haven't mentioned this, Michael, but it's absolutely fascinating on this issue is the aging of the population. And another statistic that I found fascinating was in 1960, 15% of the planet was under 5 years old, and about 5% was over 65. Mm. That number is actually flipping. And by, I believe it's 2030, it will actually be the opposite. And so you've got an aging population with many fewer younger people to support. So it's not just the total population, but it's also the makeup of that population.
And there's also, I mean, one has to factor in as well in this whole calculus, curiosity, sexuality, love. I mean, it's not to say that people in their 160s can't find love. It just maybe the thinning of the population or the herd makes it less likely, or just aging to some extent sort of has its effect on our passions, on our libido, on all of those kinds of things. There's no getting around it.
Absolutely. In fact, I somewhat whimsically at the beginning of the book rewrote some of the lyrics to When I'm 64. And one of the rewrites was, if I'd been married 23 times, would that bother you? And, you know, the idea of finding meaning in extending lifespan or greater meaning or love, I think, is something we have to really think about.
Yeah, I mean, when you extend life, you assume, oh, it's going to be sort of like it is now, not necessarily that I'm a lot more feeble or my opportunities have dwindled and diminished or just the kinds of things that often result from the aging process. I mean, it has to all be factored in, I think. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Phil. Good morning.
Hi. Simple question. It has to do with, again, reproduction and evolution. Extending the life, would that necessarily make us a weaker species or weaken the species or necessarily just a general question?
Well, I think that's a fascinating question. We haven't really brought up the idea of, say, plagues, pathogens, other disasters, which I think is partly what you're asking about. You know, if we lock, for instance, the population into very long lifespans with the same gene pool we have now, you know, geneticists and biologists know what happens when we do that. You become basically somewhat defenseless for newly developing viruses, microbes, other things. We haven't mentioned also wars, depressions. You know, I talk in the book, we have a little historical section about, you know, I think people, you know, during the decline of Rome, for instance, or maybe during the Great Depression in America would have had very different answers than when those civilizations were at their height.
I thank the caller. Economy can affect longevity or desire for longevity. Many people feel not worth living if I can't find meaningful work, or it's not worth living if I'm not flourishing or not prosperous. Mike writes on our website, this compares nicely with the program last week on the male biological clock. Nature's lifespan is a reproductive cycle, procreating and raising offspring and maybe a few years of enjoyment. Why more? Pass on your knowledge and move over for the next generation. And let's move on to another caller. And Brandon, that's you. Good morning.
Hey, guys. Great topic. So I kind of wanted to chime in with the whole, I think we're personally going to have a Malthusian-type correction. I mean, whether it's by water, oil shortage, or whatever. If you look at charts of the population and you look at a lot of the issues that we're facing, I mean, it's really, like this is like one of the earlier callers said, really a moot point. But more so than that, just technical, I have a science background. Doesn't most of the large cells on the cellular level, I think this would be pretty much physically impossible. It's not a matter of science advancing, just because the physics of water is that it expands when it's frozen. And a lot of the little cells undergo a process called lysis. I'm surprised you didn't tell that one guy who was so pom-pom waving over the whole prospect. And the last thing I want to comment, if you would, there's, I think it's kind of, given that there's other pressing issues like, you know, feeding people and there's so many other issues that we're going to, technical issues with coming up, say, you know, green fuels that are going to get us off of fossil fuels or other challenges with global warming. Like, really, shouldn't any, you know, productive thinking and science really go towards such a scientific endeavor? And really, it's not going to help people who need it, but rather, like, that whole 1% expansion that is unnecessary when we have other challenges. Like I said, they're going to threaten the Malthusian correction that's coming. like much sooner than anybody thinks, I think.
Malthusian rather than Methuselian or something
right.
like that.
Right, right. Just had a major bad correction due to, you know, who knows what, but there's so many issues. Pick a topic, you know?
Yeah,
anyway.
Well, you make good points. And Brandon, thank you for the call. He was talking about cryogenics again, though, and on the cellular level, he's got a good point.
Right, and you know, just you know, to not to overly push that, but that is the part that they have been working on and trying to figure out how to. That's one of the issues of removing the water from the body. And if you, there are a couple websites around cryonics. If you Google it, and you can find out, there has been some science done on that. That's not pseudoscience.
Well, again, the book, and it's an e-book, is out. It's called When I'm 164, The New Science of Radical Life Extension and What Happens If It Succeeds. It's an e-book, and congratulations for the book and for putting it out there as an e-book. As I said, it's bold. It's part of this brave new world that we're moving into as we get older. Thank you for being with us this hour, and I just want to remind listeners that you can find a link to David Ewing Duncan's TED Talk on this subject on our site just by going to kqed.org/forum. And on the 7th of September, he'll be at the Modernism Gallery in San Francisco talking at 5:30 at what it promises to be, unusually enough, an e-book launch. We appreciate your being with us here this hour and remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and you can find past programs there in our archives that you may indeed want to avail yourself of. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Amanda Stupai, and Tina Lauerberg. We also had production help this week from Suki Lewis and Katrina Schwartz. I want to again welcome Irene Noguchi, who is now part of our team. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. We hope we will be with you on tomorrow. Stay tuned to this station, which is KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.